You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, it's National Teacher Appreciation Day. We want to hear from you about a teacher who made a difference in your life. But first, if you consider how long you might live, you might think about a lot of different factors, why you might live a longer or shorter time compared to other people. Maybe it's your diet or exercise or smoking, or maybe you take steps to reduce your stress. But hey, maybe it's your zip code. According to a new study, for people in the United States, where you live could have a huge influence on your lifespan, especially if you're poor. Michael Stepner is a researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-author of this new study. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with kind of one of the two big results from this study. You found that wealthier people had a longer life expectancy than less wealthy people. How big a difference are we talking about here?
These gaps are quite large. The gap for men between the richest 1% and the poorest 1% is 15 years, and for women, that gap is 10 years. Just to give you a bit of perspective for that, the gap in the United States between a lifetime smoker and somebody who's never smoked a cigarette is 10 years.
That's a big difference. So a huge question is, why? Why this big difference? What are the contributing factors that people are looking at?
Right. So in our data, we're not able to tell you the causal factors. We're not able to tell you this is why a poor person is living a long time, this is why a rich person is living a long time. What we are able to do is tell you what local factors are explaining the national pattern. So when you look at a map of life expectancy for the poor in the United States, what are the characteristics of the areas where the poor are living long lives, and what are the characteristics of the areas where the poor are living short lives?
And then, I want to jump in and say that's the other big finding here, as I understand it, that if you're rich, no matter where you are, you're going to live longer. If you're poor, it really depends on your zip code in some ways. Talk about how wide a gap there is from one place to another for someone maybe at the same low-income level.
So, as you said, for the rich, there's very small gaps across the United States, in the sense it doesn't matter very much where you live. The rich have long lives regardless. For the poor, there are big gaps across areas. So the difference between the highest life expectancy areas for the poor and the lowest life expectancy areas is 5 years. And, you know, again, to give you a perspective of just how big that is, the CDC estimates that if we were to cure cancer in the United States, life expectancies would rise by 3 years. So I think of these gaps as huge.
That is huge. So where are the places where lower-income people seem to be living longer?
So the places where low-income people are living longer, so do you mean the, like, where in the United States?
Right,
or what are
exactly.
The characteristics of these places?
Where in the United States, and then we'll get into the characteristics, yeah.
Sure thing. So places like California, New York, are places where the poor have the longest lives in the United States. Wisconsin is somewhere right in the middle in terms of life expectancy in the United States. The places with the lowest life expectancy for the poor include Nevada and also this belt that extends right next to Wisconsin from Michigan all the way down through Ohio all the way until Kansas. That's the like next 8 states with the lowest life expectancy form this belt right in the center of the country.
Let's look at those places where poorer people live longer. What do they seem to have in common? What characteristics are you looking at?
So one thing they have in common is that they have healthy behaviors. They have low rates of smoking, low rates of obesity, and high rates of exercise. And that's just consistent across the board, where the places where the poor have healthy behaviors also have longer life expectancies. A different characteristic that we see show up quite robustly is that affluent areas, places with high home values, high government expenditures, high numbers of immigrants, in those places, the poor are also living longer.
So if I'm poor and I'm looking to extend my lifespan, I'm better off, it looks like, if I'm living in a place where there are wealthier people, more affluent people, than where everyone is poor like me.
So I want to caution you there, because one thing we can't say is, if you are poor, what to do to extend your lifespan?
Right. So
we
relocating
aren't able to give
today
a causal story and telling you what to do to as an individual to have a longer lifespan. Of course, there are lots of other studies that suggest cutting back on smoking, reducing, like not increasing your exercise rates. There's lots of research done by doctors and others that suggests that would increase your lifespan. That's not something our study can bring to the table. Mm-hmm. Our study does say, however, that the poor who are living in these affluent areas are living longer. And there are a few different potential reasons why.
Yeah, what are those reasons?
So one potential reason is that in these areas with sort of activist governments that are trying to promote health actively in their community, these are the places where you have indoor smoking bans, where you might have a trans fat ban, where you might have high taxes on cigarettes. These might be the places where the government is most involved in promoting the health of its citizens. Another potential story, which is completely different, is that the poor who live in these areas could simply be quite different. So we talked about how these are places with high numbers of immigrants. Places like New York City, you know, to be poor in New York City is quite a different experience from being poor in Gary, Indiana. And you have a very different set of people with different job prospects, different from different origins who are living in New York. And so those are two potential stories about what's going on there.
Talking to Michael Stepner from MIT about new research on life expectancy in the United States, rich versus poor, and poor depending on where you live and how wealthy a community you live in. Michael, I would think in some ways this is counterintuitive, because if you're low income and trying to make it in Brooklyn or San Francisco, you have so much higher fixed costs. Housing costs more. A lot of the basics of life cost more. You'd think that might make life harder for that poor person in those communities versus living in a less affluent area.
I completely agree. So it's really expensive to live in San Francisco or New York if you're poor, and yet we see that these are the places where the poor have the longest life expectancies.
Yeah, let's talk some more about that. What is it in these communities, a place like San Francisco, that would maybe even counteract that higher cost of living?
There are a variety of things about New York and San Francisco. One thing is that in New York, everybody walks. New Yorkers, when I talk to New Yorkers, they pride themselves on the fact that, oh, they walk everywhere. Rich and poor are, you know, mobile within the city. New York is, as I mentioned, New York has also been a pioneer in these public health interventions. In our study, we're not able to say what the effect of those interventions was on the life expectancy of the poor. But since when we look across America, we see that the places with the lowest smoking rates and the lowest obesity rates have the longest life expectancies, it suggests that any intervention which would affect those has the potential to raise the life expectancies of low-income Americans and reduce those gaps between the rich and the poor. And so we are very excited about follow-on research, any other research that might follow this that actually gets at what is the effect of different interventions that can act on this.
You know, Michael, I see research over the years suggesting that in the United States we're becoming more economically segregated. This is reaching maybe beyond your research, but it sounds like that would be bad news if low-income people do better in more economically mixed communities. That would potentially make things worse in the long run if we're sorting ourselves out by income, by class.
Well, one thing we actually looked at is we actually directly studied whether places that are economically segregated, where the rich live separately from the poor, have lower life expectancy for the poor. Because you might imagine a number of reasons why. One thing is just local pollution. If in a given area, low-income Americans are living next to the factory or living next to the highway, whereas rich Americans are living in leafy suburbs, that could have a direct impact on asthma and all sorts of other health factors that would lower lifespans. You also have stories about food deserts, where the rich might live next to great grocery stores with everything they need, and poor Americans might live in areas with no grocery stores. So both of those stories would suggest that in places where the rich and the poor live cheek by jowl, you wouldn't be able to have that sort of negative impact on the life expectancy of the poor compared to the rich. And we actually find no support for that.
Hmm.
So in places where the rich and the poor live separately, we see no difference in the life expectancies of the poor compared to the places where they live together.
One thing we haven't talked about as a factor so far is the idea of a social safety net. Is that part of the story here, that maybe the places that are more affluent also have more attention to some kind of social safety net for those lower income residents?
So I think there's potential for that story at a local level. One surprising thing we found at the national level is that we don't see evidence of a safety net in the national data. And let me explain. You might have thought that after a certain point, having lower income no longer affects life expectancy because after a certain point, the social safety net will catch you. And government programs will make sure that if your income continues to fall, you will stop. You will no longer be affected. You know, these safety net will catch you. We don't see that. So, as income falls from the 10th percent from the 10th percentile in the United States to the 5th percentile to the 1st percentile, life expectancies continue to fall. That surprised us. We were expecting perhaps that the social safety net was effective in mitigating, in preventing this relationship between income and life expectancy at the very lowest levels. You mentioned at the local level that these local programs might be effective, and I think that's quite plausible.
Are there any lessons here with this research? Are there things that you think policymakers should do, or at least to look at this research and think about doing based on what you found here?
So I think there are two big lessons, one at a local level and one at a national level. One thing that we've seen over the last 10 years in the United States is that all of the discussion around health inequality has really been at a national level, focused around the Affordable Care Act and other national programs. What we see is that so much of the variation happens at the local level that no national solution can hope to address these local gaps in life expectancy. So our research suggests that there's enormous potential for local programs to help raise the life expectancies of the poor and close the gaps between the poor and the rich. Our research also suggests that public health interventions that lower smoking or lower obesity, raise exercise, that those have the potential to help close these gaps. And as I mentioned, I'm very excited about work that starts to identify which are the most effective interventions that can help in that goal.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Stepner is a researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the co-author of the study we've been talking about showing that where you live can have an impact on your lifespan. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the American College of Physicians released new guidelines today for chronic insomnia. They're recommending cognitive behavioral therapy as the first-line treatment instead of sleeping pills. We'll talk about barriers in place that might prevent patients from following that advice and getting their insomnia treated. First, happy National Teacher Appreciation Day. Every year, the Tuesday of the first full week of May is designated as a day to celebrate teachers. It's part of Teacher Appreciation Week in the first full week of May each year. The National Education Association says National Teacher Day is a day to honor teachers and recognize the lasting contributions they make to our lives. Well, now we want to hear from you about a teacher who changed your life. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us about a teacher that changed your life. Share your memories. How did your teachers change your lives? Your life? Do you still keep in touch with them? And if you're a parent now, how do you see a teacher changing your kid's life? Call in now. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I will go right to our callers. Dan is on the line in Brule. Dan, hi.
Hello.
Hi. Who do you want to tell us about, Dan?
I was going to tell you about a teacher that I had in high school. His name was Carl Brugink in Clintonville, Wisconsin.
And what was special about Mr. Brugink?
Yep. Carl, he helped me to understand that I could continue on and carry on and pursue my enjoyment of life by continuing education and going after what I wanted to do. And he encouraged me a lot, and he was fantastic. He helped a lot of people.
Well, what was it that he did? What was it that made him make a difference for you?
Well, he was always encouraging that you could, even though if maybe you had a little bit of a stumble, whether it was in athletics or sports or what have you, that you could carry on and continue improving, always improving through education.
Resilience. Thank you so much, Dan, for sharing that story. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Let us know about a teacher who had a positive impact on your life. We asked around here at WPR. Aubrey Ralph, our radio operations control manager, said, quoting him now, "I was a terrible kid in high school, slept in class, did stuff, lots of stuff I shouldn't have done, but I always did very well in marching band. The structure of it caught me somehow. Sophomore year, for the same reason," Aubrey says, "I joined the junior ROTC program. For the fitness part, we were instructed by Sergeant Major Warren. He was a tough, almost literal leather-necked Marine. He says he got me to push myself farther than I ever thought I could. When he handed out praise, you really knew he meant it." That's Aubrey's story. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Dodie is on the line in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling about my children's kindergarten teacher. They both had the same teacher, Kelly McCann, in the Madison Public School District at Thoreau Elementary. And she was the most amazing teacher. She just helped them so much on their transition from preschool to elementary school. And she taught them so many skills that are good for life and about how to treat everyone well and to just never be mean. I'm so impressed with her.
How old are your kids now?
They're 17 and 20, and that's the teacher I remember best.
And do they remember that teacher too?
Oh, yeah.
They
totally do.
They
still call her Miss Kelly. Yeah.
That's
fantastic. They admire her a lot.
That's fantastic, Dodie. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Taking your stories about a favorite teachers, yours or your kids, on National Teacher Appreciation Day at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us now in Germantown. Kathy, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to send out a huge shout out to a woman named Lisa Lau. She was my son's K-4 teacher many years ago, and thanks to her intervention and care, we figured out that he had a severe hearing deficit and was able to help us get services and helped us get into an audiologist at Children's Hospital quicker than we ever thought was possible. And she will ever have a strong place, a big place in our hearts.
I bet, Kathy. That's huge to catch that, especially at that early age.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Nancy joins us next in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi. The teacher that made the largest impact in my life was Donna Shute. She was instrumental in starting many mental health programs. She pushed me beyond what I thought I was capable of doing. She gave me more confidence in myself than I ever imagined I could have. She was just such a positive person. And I thank her every day for the job that I have right now, because if it wasn't for her seeking out the best in me, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
So she was positive, and she pushed you, too, at the same time.
Yes, yeah.
That's great, Nancy.
A gentle nudge. She was great.
A gentle nudge. Thank you so much, Nancy. Allie is with us next now in Manitowoc. Allie, hi.
Hi.
Tell us about your teacher, Allie.
So the teacher that I'm calling in regard to was not actually a positive teacher at all. We had students that were mainstreamed into our classrooms who had special needs. And instead of setting an example to treat these students with respect, he made fun of them and he belittled them. And I questioned it and I disagreed with it. And so as a result of having this teacher, I learned that, it carried on through my life, that when you have somebody who you're supposed to look up to and who is in an authoritative position, does not mean that you cannot question them and try to do something to change the negative that they're bringing about in the situation.
Interesting, Allie. Thank you so much for sharing that. Taking your calls on National Teacher Appreciation Day, 800-642-1234. Remember a teacher who was an influence on your life. Morgan joins us next in Ashland. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Teacher that made the most influence on my education was a lady named Zelda Butler in fourth grade. Up until fourth grade, I kind of struggled on and off with schoolwork. When I started fourth grade, my mother told me, made a visit to Mrs. Butler and said, "Don't take any of the crap this kid's giving you. Make him work." So I went in there with kind of a fear to start with, because I knew she was very demanding, but she took me aside one day and complimented me on how well I was doing, and it just made me have a more positive outlook on my my life, I guess, you know, and I never forgot that.
That one teacher saying that one thing in a way, and that attitude for the year, that really turned it around for you.
It really did. And after that, I expected more of myself. And every time I saw her after that, she's deceased now, but every time I saw her after that, I always complimented her on the change she made in me. And I'm sure she did in other kids, too. So,
Morgan, thank you so much for sharing that story. We've got Ashley on the line next in Lafarge. Ashley, hi.
Hi.
Oh, who do you want to tell us about, Ashley?
I want to tell you about my preschool and kindergarten teacher, Ellen Thielen. She was just amazing, and we came from a really small school, and she actually held me back my preschool year. And you would think for some kids that would be detrimental, but she knew I wasn't ready to go on. She was a tough love kind of teacher, but she knew when to be tough and knew when to be more nurturing, and she was just amazing, and she really helped instill in me a love of reading and just being a good person.
Ashley, thank you so much. Thanks to everyone who called in and shared your favorite teacher, a teacher who made a difference in your life. You can keep that going, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR over at Facebook. Still time to share your story there. Coming up, cognitive behavioral therapy is getting rave reviews from doctors' groups, including most recently for insomnia. Just one problem, it's hard for patients to actually get it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA with a focus this week on the presidential campaign, including the Latino identity of Ted Cruz, why there's a generation gap among Latinos when it comes to voting, and a report on Hillary Clinton's relationship with the coup in Honduras. First, if you have trouble sleeping, you might just suffer through it or reach for the sleeping pills. But today, the American College of Physicians released new guidelines for chronic insomnia. Now they're recommending cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia as a first-line treatment. That means doctors, in these recommendations anyway, would prescribe cognitive therapy before they write a prescription for a sleeping pill. Just one problem, according to our next guest. It's easy to fill that prescription for pills, not so easy to get access to therapy or get insurance to pay for it. Dr. Roger Cathal joins us now to talk about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia and other conditions. He just wrote an editorial that accompanies the new guidelines about the challenges of implementing them. He's an adjunct professor in psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Cathal, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Rob.
So cognitive behavioral therapy in the news today, what is it? How does it work?
So it's a form of cognitive and behavioral learning process that allows people that have chronic insomnia to identify the things that create the problem and to then systematically utilize techniques to overcome the problem.
And we're hearing about it today because of insomnia. It's not used, this process of cognitive behavioral therapy isn't just for insomnia. What all conditions are people using it for?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is really used for a wide variety of psychiatric conditions, including depression, anxiety, various kinds of personality disorders, and many other very specific things that people are having difficulty with.
A lot of people might hear the word therapy and think you're on the couch and you're talking about your dreams or looking at ink blots, things like that. This, as I understand it, this is pretty different. What makes it different from what we usually think of as psychiatric therapy?
Okay, the old therapies where you think about couches and et cetera are reflective therapies, sort of what I call there and then therapies, whereas cognitive behavioral is a here and now. It's identifying difficulties a person is having in their lives and then helping them to identify the things that are contributing to it and develop skills that will help them to overcome the problem. So cognitive behavioral therapy typically is time limited. It's forward thinking. It's not backward thinking. And it really has solid evidence in many conditions of value to people that have various kinds of mental health and substance use conditions.
Right, it has value, and in this case for sleep, maybe more value than medications or more value when used in addition to medications. This stuff, in some cases, might lead to less need for medications. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. This allows a person to not just treat a symptom, but to treat the cause of the problem that they're having, in this case, insomnia. And so it defines the underlying behaviors and sort of the thought processes that are contributing to it, helps a person to understand those, develop skills to overcome those, and then in the long term, they can, you know, people that use this approach to treatment of insomnia can come back to it, reinitiate the things that they learned if they have difficulty, and not have to go back to or start medication.
Talking to Dr. Roger Cathal from the University of Minnesota, new recommendations out from a national physicians group saying for chronic insomnia, docs try cognitive behavioral therapy first before prescribing sleeping pills. So, Dr. Cathal, this sounds great, but as you and your colleague write in an editorial, it's not really that easy, is it? First of all, some doctors don't even think insomnia is a health problem. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, doctors are so busy today that they tend to overlook some things that really contribute to difficulties with other parts of their lives. And in fact, insomnia can be a contributor to poor outcomes for chronic other medical conditions, such as heart disease or kidney disease or lung disease. And so identifying and effectively treating insomnia is an important thing. And doctors really just need to become more aware that this is an area that is important in people's lives.
That's one hurdle you point out. Another is that if you're talking to a medical doctor, your family practice doctor, say, they may either not think that a psychological intervention is valid or have experience with it. How big a problem is that?
Well, unfortunately, we live in a medical world in which mental health and substance use disorder conditions are treated in a completely segregated compartment within medical practice. And so family practitioners, general internists, and other medical doctors don't have a lot of interaction with mental health professionals, and they therefore don't keep up with the literature showing that there are now effective treatments, psychological treatments for many conditions that really should be considered as first line. There have been many years in which mental health conditions have been more difficult to effectively control. In the past 20 to 30 years, major advances have been made in mental health and substance use treatment, and we now have effective treatments that now has to spread to the rest of the medical community so that they understand that it's available, it's worthwhile using, and in fact, in this case, should be used as a first-line care form of treatment.
So let's say I have chronic insomnia, and hey, I'm lucky, I've got a doctor who recognizes that it's a health problem, who knows about cognitive behavioral therapy, says, yep, Rob, that's what you need. Can I get it? Is it out there? Is it accessible?
Okay, so now this is the other problem that we have. Since behavioral health practitioners practice in a separate segment of the medical setting, it's difficult to get the people that have insomnia to the people that do the therapy because they typically don't practice in the medical setting where people are usually seen. And so the solution to that is to bring the therapist into the medical setting, which is would be the ideal thing, but the payers for behavioral health services do not pay for behavioral health practitioners in the medical setting. Therefore, you have to do what I call economic or payment workarounds in order to get access to the professionals that actually do this. There is more recently a large group of cognitive behavioral apps that people can access, and there are now a significant number of studies that demonstrate that these electronic sort of systematic processes that go through the behavioral learning that a therapist would do can be almost as effective, not quite as effective as a therapist, but it's an alternative that doctors and patients can go to if, in fact, there are no therapists available in their particular location to get this form of treatment.
I want to bring in a caller on that point, actually, at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hey. I'm a PA in family practice and actually just was going to bring up exactly what your guest just brought up. And I was alerted to an app actually from a family doc in Canada. Dr. Mike Evans has a great health website called Sleepio. It's a site that basically helps patients tune into the number of the factors that may be associated with their inability to fall asleep and or stay asleep. And then it is a paying app, but I always kind of couch it to my patients as, you know, if you're going to pay for therapy or go to sessions, that this may be well worth your money, and the risks are really minimal in terms of cost, and that the benefits may be great and lifelong, because I tend to tell my patients that sleep is really a skill that is really important for a healthy living, and so I think of it as one of the most important things I actually talk about in my practice.
Dave, thanks a lot for your call and bringing all that up. Dr. Cathal, a lot there, and it sounded like you were saying an app better than nothing, but still probably not as good as actually working one-on-one with a therapist.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the biggest and most important and challenging things is that people that have insomnia tend to get into habits that perpetuate the insomnia, and changing those habits is not easy. And so having a person rather than an app help them through it. Now, doctors like Dave will be a great asset to patients that choose to use an app because he, in his practice, sounds like he understands the importance of treatment of insomnia and can support the person through doing the cognitive behavioral therapy. It is not an easy process. It is something that you have to learn, so it's not like sprinkling pixie dust and it all goes away. There's a process that takes a little bit of time, over 4 to 6 weeks, to improve the process or the sleep. But once that learning has taken place and the improvement has occurred, then it is something that people can go back to for long periods of time. And in fact, the follow-up studies show that those that use cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia actually have a good long-term outcomes because they can always go back to the things that they learned if they start having some difficulty again.
We're talking to Dr. Roger Cathal from the University of Minnesota about the news that cognitive behavioral therapy is now the first line of treatment for chronic insomnia, not sleeping pills. He says it's a good idea, but it can be hard for patients to get access to that kind of treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia or something else? Would you ever try this kind of treatment? Do you think it's difficult to find people who can do this? And if you're a healthcare provider, is this something you're encountering more and more at your practice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Roger Cathal about new guidelines from the American College of Physicians. They now recommend for people with chronic insomnia, cognitive behavioral therapy as the first line treatment instead of sleeping pills. But he says there's not enough awareness often among physicians, access to care or insurance coverage for that kind of therapy. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234 if you've encountered cognitive behavioral therapy as a patient or a practitioner. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go back to our callers now with Mike on the line in West Bend. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think, Mike?
Good. I went to cognitive behavioral therapy for obsessive compulsive disorder, and I did a 6-week program, and it totally changed my life. I was on medications after medications, and nothing would work. You know, I did have insomnia, and the best therapy was going through mental hierarchy and taking each problem and dealing with it.
And Mike, was this, in a way you're learning a set of mental skills that you're getting trained in over that 6 weeks?
Right, exactly. It's basically a rewiring of your brain by, you know, I did hierarchies of things that would make me, you know, anxious, I'd obsess about, and we'd build stories, we'd build, you know, things to deal with that and sit with the anxiety or sit with the problems and then repeat until I was able to deal with it myself without any medication.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Cathel, Mike used the phrase rewiring his brain. Is that in effect what you're doing? You're changing behaviors and thought processes and eventually changing the way your brain is working a little bit?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, Mike's is a good example of just one of the many mental health conditions in which cognitive behavioral therapy is effective. We're still doing research on the actual mechanism through which cognitive behavioral therapy works. It probably is a combination of neurochemical and also behavioral and learning processes that kick in as somebody systematically goes through the causes of the difficulties a person is having, and then identifies and initiates new behaviors and sort of rewires those new behaviors into their lifestyle so that they can overcome the difficulties they were previously having. So rewiring is not a bad term.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call, and we'll go next to Joe in Slinger. Joe, hi.
Hi.
Which, what did you want to bring up, Joe? Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Joe, what did you want to tell us about?
Oh, I'm a psychotherapist, and I want people to know and understand that they can have access to cognitive behavioral therapy, that one of the best things that they can do, because any of us who have had that training need to report that to the insurance companies that we serve. So if you would call your insurance company and say, I would like to see someone who could do cognitive behavioral therapy with me. They have a list of people in the area that who could be helpful to them and can give them referrals.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. So Dr. Cathel, Joe is saying the help, the practitioners are out there, but do insurance companies generally cover this for patients?
Yeah, well, the behavioral health insurance companies cover it. Clearly, but not everybody has good behavioral health insurance. And the other thing is that most of the behavioral health insurance companies require that the therapist practice in standalone settings, which is really not where patients show up. So the ideal situation would be for the therapist to be able to practice in the you know, in the insomnia clinic or a medical clinic or what have you, where really 75% of people that have mental health issues choose to seek care and in fact avoid going to the mental health setting. So I absolutely agree. Call the insurance companies, encourage them to pay for it. In many settings, they still won't. But if there is a groundswell of activity, getting therapy on the list of things that are supported, particularly cognitive behavioral therapy, then I think that we're going to make progress.
Thanks for that call, Joe. We're talking to Dr. Roger Cathel from the University of Minnesota. New guidelines from the American College of Physicians recommending cognitive behavioral therapy for treatment of insomnia. Dr. Cathel says it's a good treatment for a lot of conditions. Access to it, doctors' awareness of it, not always there, though. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Barry is with us in Madison. Barry, hi.
Yes, hello. I have a question. How does cognitive behavior therapy work for PTSD? And because I have it when I step on things, and result is angerness, madness, because of I flash back 35-40 years ago when I stepped on a dead rat once coming back from work.
Wow. Well, Barry, I'm so sorry about that, and good luck to you. And I want to ask you, obviously we can't diagnose Barry's condition on the radio, Dr. Cathel, but in general, post-traumatic stress disorder, is that something that cognitive behavioral therapy has worked with success?
Yeah, it's one of the conditions in which cognitive behavioral therapy is in common use. And for individuals, depending upon the underlying issues, it can be very helpful to them. Again, I mean, your point for Barry is that over the phone is difficult to get into the kind of things that are contributing to the difficulties. But once you've identified the things that are contributing, then you can start learning behaviors that would counter the negative things that lead to poor outcomes.
Barry, good luck to you. And Dr. Cathal, before we run out of time, I want to get into one more point that came out of your editorial on all of this. Cognitive behavioral therapy, it's not a quick fix necessarily. It's not I write a prescription for a pill, I take a pill. Do doctors, patients, insurance companies have the patience to prioritize something like this?
Yeah, you know, obviously, the easier thing is just to prescribe a sleeping pill and let it go at that. And for short-term intermittent sleep difficulties, that's okay. But when you get into chronic insomnia where you have up to 3 days a week for a long period of time, such as a month, that a person is having difficulty with insomnia, then clearly cognitive behavioral therapy is the way to go. And it would be rightly the first line treatment. The sleep specialist organization and sleep specialists have for a long time identified cognitive behavioral therapy as a first line treatment for chronic insomnia. And so there's tremendous literature supporting it. You know, that's something that we need to start thinking about as an initial treatment rather than getting into medications which have many more side effects and potentially adverse reactions and, of course, long-term costs if you get involved with those.
Dr. Cathal, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Roger Cathal, adjunct professor in psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. He co-authored an editorial on new guidelines from the American College of Physicians who are now recommending cognitive behavioral therapy as the first line of treatment for chronic insomnia instead of sleeping pills.